netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this episode, we speak with Jordan Thistlewood, Chief Digital Officer of Cook Optics. As you'll hear in the podcast, we've been covering the role of lens metadata in VFX workflow for decades here at FX Guide. And what was once an ambitious idea has matured into a practical production tool. Jordan gets us up to date on the current state of the tech in the industry, and how Cook is working with both production and post to make it even more valuable. Before we start the interview, I just want to mention our FX Guide email service that will notify you whenever we post a new article or podcast here at FX Guide. It's a low-volume list, and we never share your email address with anyone outside of FX Guide. You can find a sign-up box on the right side of every page on the website, except for the homepage, because I refuse to implement an annoying pop-up, obscuring the site, begging you to join the list. I'll save that for this FX podcast. Okay, with that out of the way, let's go ahead and join Jordan and Mike.
Jordan, thanks so much for joining us, man. Really appreciate it.
Ah, my pleasure.
When last I saw you, I think you were getting off a plane at Heathrow or something similar.
Yeah, I think it was an early morning transit from FMX back to London. So good catch it, though.
Yeah, and it was really good seeing you. Hey, we've been tracking stuff with Cook, in particular, its role into VFX for a while. Like I was actually looking through the, we were writing stuff about iTech in 08, in 2013, we were talking about the I-squared stuff. Yeah. We've written a bunch of stuff. So I guess my question is, kind of, what's changed? Like, is this anything new? Or is it just the same? Like, what's happening with this technology in the lens? And is it any different than it was, you know, 14 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever?
I'd say fundamentally what's evolved is the ecosystem, the adoption level amongst the cameras, the sophistication of the deployment, the understanding of it. The majority of the work that we've done in the last several years has actually been on the software side. So as you would have sort of seen from your coverage back then, Les Zellin's original vision for eye technology was to basically bring cinematography and the post-production industries closer together, facilitate that overlap and that collaboration. It was missing a distinct software platform to make use of the metadata. And I think you can sort of look at it two ways. Like, cinematographers go, I love it when I'm on set, I'm doing a multi-camera shoot. I've got four or five cameras running. I can be in the DIT-10. I can see everything. I know what all the controls are on every camera. There's a level of confidence that you think a camera at the end of a techno crane, being able to see what that's set up to be. So there's that distinct sort of value in the cinema side. Then obviously, you know, there's been a lot of interest in metadata and in how it drives pipelines on the visual effects side. It's just there's been that missing gap between the two. So
I will say, like, Les actually shot with us in Sydney at my place way back in the day, and we loved it from day one because we loved the idea of it. We love the fact that you are actually getting accurate metadata, because the whole thing about Cook, apart from the fact that the lenses are gorgeous and they've been shooting with that creamy Cook look since, like, I don't know, Wizard of Oz or something. Like, it's just, there's been this amazing history, right? But leaving that optics aside for a second, the idea that these precision instruments were recording precise information about what the lens was doing seemed like a dream to us in VFX. But on those early tests, what was going wrong was it was sidecarring the data to a separate, like, card. And then you had this data stream and vision stream, and you were trying to match them up, and it was really, really awkward. But that's fundamentally completely changed, right?
Absolutely. Everything from Sony, the Alexa series from Arri, Blackmagic, Red, Confinity, and a couple others all record directly into the camera raw files through the lens mount. So then you're just faced with the possible points of, you know, the lens contacts going wrong, whatnot. But fundamentally, that whole, how do I take two separate streams of data, conform them, and deliver them is something that has fundamentally changed over the years. I mean, we're talking, you know, 20 plus years. It was 26 years ago that Les started the whole project, 2005 that the first lens series shipped. So the world's completely changed since then.
So the trick that made it, like one of the first steps that made it just brilliant, is getting that metadata actually included with the original mm-hmm. camera file. Because when it's actually there with the original camera file, you can completely trust it, because on that frame, that metadata connected, right? So I think that was like a huge, vast difference than just sidecarring it in a kind of separate data thing and then hoping like crazy that they aligned. But I would say the second problem we had is that we then were like, okay, so we got this great stuff, and we reported the Red camera when it first used the data, and we're thinking, oh, this is great. And then what we were discovering is we'd go to facilities and we'd say, have you shot with the Cook and got the metadata? And they went, no. I'm like, no. We know that you were shooting. It was, totally. Yeah. No. Somebody transcoded it and they threw it all away. And so we all got, you know, OpenEXR files, and it had no metadata. So I don't know where it was, but it never got to us. So that's been a big difference too, right? Like the transcoding, stripping stuff out is like the death of the whole concept.
I'd say it's not 100% solved, but I think the solutions are on the way, right? We talked about Flame 2027. The team put a lot of effort into fixing metadata support in Flame. There's now three commercial systems that can do VFX pulls that are actually architected from the ground up to support metadata. Groups like Company 3 have customized pipelines that ensure that the metadata gets there. So there is a level of awareness and infrastructure now that should make that sort of missing metadata or evaporation of metadata, you know, a thing of the past. And I think it's really important for visual effects supervisors, the post-production supervisors, everybody to just, you know, be very clear in the whole conversation that metadata is important, and that this is part of the deliverables, and it's an expectation, and it falls into the right sort of QC checks that go through. Because once it gets there, it's incredibly valuable.
Because, I mean, in the old days, you'd say, oh, we really want this metadata. And someone would say, well, yeah, sure, but if it's going to cost us a bunch more money, it's just not going to happen. Yeah. But even if something doesn't necessarily read the metadata, you just don't want it to strip the metadata. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the situation with, say, DaVinci and Resolve?
So I did a test on the current version 21 beta, and though the team have not yet got to the level of sophistication that the metadata is viewable within the UI, in the case where I took a Sony MXF RAW file and transcoded it to EXRs, it's all there. So I'd encourage everybody to look at their tools and just kind of do those sense checks and understand what's there in the raw files from the point of view of the manufacturer's tools, and then look at it for what they get in Nuke. And chances are it's getting a lot better.
So I guess the last part of that jigsaw puzzle for me is having some kind of standard. So mm-hmm. everybody just goes, oh yeah, we, because like I don't think I've ever been on the set where the camera department or the operators or anybody else was anything but keen to give everybody else downstream everything they possibly needed. It's just a matter of knowing that it's really useful and making sure that you don't accidentally now effectively remove what is this really valuable resource. So as you just said a second ago, it's almost now at the point that you just need to have a collective voice from our community saying this should be standard, and there's no reason why it couldn't be, is there?
That's pretty much it. Every DIT, every person I've talked to on the camera team, DPs themselves, when you explain what's actually possible because of the metadata, we've tried to take a very technological conversation at Cook and turn it into something that is maybe a bit more esoteric. You know, I've given presentations where I explain the DPs that metadata is their love letter to visual effects, because they don't often get there to work with a visual effects artist, but they are their partners in crime of completing these beautiful images. And so when you explain that every choice that they've made on set, every bit of the focus choreography that they painstakingly work towards, all their exposure controls, all those things are just inherently in that metadata, and the value that is to a visual effects team, they become pretty big champions of it. DITs, their request is just ask for it. Like, we will try and get it as a default, but don't be shy. ask for it, because then they can do something about it. Same thing, be very clear on the post-production requirements in terms of what you're asking for, in terms of VFX pulls, ask for the metadata. There is, it's harder to not deliver it now than it is to deliver it. So just making sure everybody's has the right diligence in the process is the key thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think once it's the sort of, because if it's not costing anything, it's just a really a matter of just having the habitual nature of doing it in place, and then it's going to become like the tipping point where it's all just to be expected, and you'd be surprised if it wasn't. So is that your pitch, though, to, like, let's say I was coming to you as a really good, really dedicated on-set camera guy, and I was you know, at the pub or whatever, and you were pitching at a night or whatever, what would that be your pitch, or how would you sort of articulate it to camera department?
The way we've been explained to the camera department is that everything that is in their craft, that is their passion, right? And when you think about it, in a lot of scenarios, you've got, depending on the shoot, if it, maybe the DP is operating, they're pointing the camera, they're choosing the exposure, but still there's another person focusing, right? And there's always somebody that's on, you know, controlling focus. And so it's always a multidisciplinary. There's people that have built a craft. There's creative choices that go into everything. When you explain that the, without this metadata, that the way that their best work can be represented, maintained, and respected is this very crude process of, okay, well, we're going to get the script, the notes from set, but that's going to give approximations. And then what for visual effects artists has to do is you've got a blue screen, green screen, minimal physical set, and they sit there and they step through frames trying to do their best to reverse engineer what was the focus choreography on set. That,
I mean, literally, people just were setting up witness cameras just to not so much see what the actors were doing, but see what the camera was doing relative to the actors when at all possible without getting in the way, which is an absurdly analog step if you think about it, given that you've got such precision coming out of the lens. It's just mad.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think when you engage in a conversation about equal respect for the craft, and that, you know, visual effects is really just trying to deliver an honor against the work that happened on set and be the part of the team that creates the final image. There's a lot of conversations that open up, and I don't know if it was the strikes, I don't know if it was the pandemic, if times just evolved, but people are really receptive to this. They want to help. There was one gentleman, he's that works here in London. He's a first AC, and he's a bit of a unicorn. His roommate is a visual effects artist. And so through the pandemic, everybody working from home, he got to witness firsthand how his roommate was like, oh gosh, I didn't get this information. I didn't get the chrome balls. I didn't get this, that, everything else. And how hard that made his roommate's life. And so it was that understanding of how passionate his roommate was about trying to accomplish the best results to respect the filmmaking, but without the right information on how they couldn't. It was eye-opening, and I think it's more of those conversations. So this isn't really a technology conversation. This is about people that are equally invested in filmmaking, just from different contribution levels at different points in the schedule and different techniques, all being set up to succeed.
And I think we should say at this point, this is not like esoteric. Like, this is actually happening and working really well. Like, for example, Hail Mary used this technology incredibly effectively.
Yeah, I think you and I both talked with Stuart from Framestore and mentioning how they were able to take the focus distance data and plug that into the comp and then actually drive the defocus of the visual effects by what happened on set. And that's just one of many stories of where that's taken place. And I think that just goes to show then the whole technical process of trying to figure out what happened on set is removed. And then it's really a focus on how do we aesthetically manage the look of the lens through its various stages of defocus based on the focus distance and the subject distance. And that changes the whole conversation, that changes the focus, and the effort goes into the aesthetics rather than into the technical. And that's where camera team love it.
I think many people listening to this podcast would know this, but it's worth saying out loud. Like, there obviously is no sense of something being in focus and out of focus, right? There's no like sudden in focus and it's suddenly out of focus. There's a range of space that is deemed to be in focus by the kind of the eye of the DOP and, for that matter, the director, right? Like, I mean, we think of it as being in focus and out of focus, but it's not a black and white thing. So if you're trying to eyeball that, and you've got four things a meter apart, you'll say, okay, well, the middle one is the most in focus, and we'll call that in focus. But actually working out where the focus is, it could be anywhere sort of forwards and backwards around the one thing that you've isolated, while still having that same object deemed to be in focus. So the complexity of the focus solution is so much more nuanced when we actually have the camera data than trying to eyeball it. You just can't eyeball a gradation of focus with the kind of accuracy you could ever approximate from what you guys do.
Well, I also think it's the uniqueness of each lens. And I think what maybe isn't as well understood is how much time cinematographers pick using various lenses, and how they know exactly what to expect of a lens based on the camera format and the lens that they've chosen. And therefore, a lot of the conversations we've had are not that they're dissatisfied with the choreography as much as they know how that lens would have behaved if everything that was added in visual effects was real and they had just filmed it. And so they can view it from that point of view. And so the real challenge is, how do you remove the technical nature up front, so then the analysis can go into how would that lens behave? Now there's groups like us and Zeiss and others that are putting effort into modeling how lenses behave, matched against metadata, so that that intrinsic knowledge that we hold can be just given to visual effects artists. Otherwise, then you have to have that sort of one, shall we say, lens enthusiast on the team that goes through and sets up the tools and the pipeline and things like that to try and minimize the guesswork that other comp artists or visual effects artists have to do.
I mean, if you think about like a triangle of three things, like you guys are doing this insanely great work in producing not just a good lens, but a good lens that's reliable. And if I hire another lens that's the same, you know, I get another 50 mil in a different country on a different, it's going to match pretty closely to the first one, right? They're not vastly variant, because you have precision in your... And then if you go to the other end of the spectrum to post, we got all this trouble for ACES workflow, so it can really accurately make sure that the colors hit their mark. But the third part of that triangle is this weird place where people are just completely guessing stuff. And it's like, well, you've got all the trouble to make the lens precise. We've got all this trouble to make the color exact. But in the middle, what the distance was, what the focus was doing, like a whole bunch of data around exposure and how the light would be behaving is otherwise just guessed at, which is so ironic given the other two sort of nearly fanatical approaches to try and get accuracy. It makes no sense to not deploy this stuff.
Well, and you know, to your question earlier, like what's changed, what have we been doing, that third point is really what we're trying to address with the metadata and then giving the metadata a better home. Cook spent a lot of time in the last decade working on lens characterization that is really driven by the metadata. And there's a lot of things that, you know, we're looking to put out in future white papers so that visual effects can understand this. We've got our one on sort of the camera and lens definitions for visual effects. But when you go on to even think about, there's just things like the optical design process. When our team and pretty much all the teams in the industry are designing lenses, the one thing you can count on is infinity focus. So then all the statistics around the lens are based around designing that as if the lens was focused at infinity. So when you see 32 millimeters engraved on the side of a lens, that is the state of that. That is the intention for what that lens should have as a field of view coverage at infinity focus. Now you get back into the question, how often does a DP actually focus at infinity? And the answer is usually not very often. And then you sort of have the acknowledgement of, well, what actually happens to the behavior of the lens when it's not infinity? And there's a lot of, you know, for me, very fascinating things that take place. And I've come to sort of describe lenses as living, breathing objects, not just because, you know, sort of the lens breathing, but it really is. As a team on set is using that lens, it has a whole dynamic behavior. And you can't snapshot it. It's a very organic analog curve to it. So the chances for someone to really have understood how to interpret that, even with the metadata, become difficult. So that's the next level of where things are going.
Let me ask you this. We've been talking as if, like, you know, you just said 32, I'd say 50. Like, these are prime lenses. How far does the tech go in mapping a zoom lens?
So zoom lenses are trickier. We do have the ability to generate data for our own zoom lenses. And then we have been able to build distortion technologies and characterization technologies that then respect that. But I'd say it's not as precise as the physically measured opportunities. There are some things in underway that we could probably increase that. But I'd say at this point, we haven't quite got our finger on the pulse of can we make our subpixel accurate claims on zoom characterization the way that we can with our primes?
Yeah, I mean, we hope that that'll be coming. But I will say this, like, what you can get is, again, going to be so much better than what you can guess that I would argue even if you could get 90% of the way there, that's, like, you know, probably 50% more than you could get if you were eyeballing it. So there's a lot that I'm not saying there isn't room for improvement, but, like, a zoom lens has obviously a huge amount of issues, not least of which is how things are changing, you know, dynamically during the zoom. So, I mean, sometimes people are using zooms and they're locked at a particular zoom, if you know what I mean. Other times they're actually doing the zoom during the shot, and mapping that during an actual zoom. That's, I guess, not as common a feature of cinematography these days as it once was, but it's certainly one of the more technically
Shot.
Yeah, it's a technically difficult shot.
But I think so here, to give you an idea, so using the 32 mil example again, so our full frame anamorphic, the 32 mil model, using the pinhole focal length values, the variety of pinhole focal lengths at the close focus ranges between 32.75 and 33.1 based on the data that we've got from all the measurements. Then that curve changes, obviously, based on that. So when you think about that kind of almost steep relationship between focus distance and those values, then getting an accurate assessment of what the true focal length is at any position of the zoom dial, because there's always going to be a discrepancy. And I think this is the thing that is the challenge for visual effects, is that we do our best, like every other lens manufacturer, to represent things as precisely as possible. But when you take into account the distortion and then how that derives, removing that, what's left for the pinhole focal length, the values that are used on set and spoken about and whatnot don't always correlate to what visual effects needs. And that's why the sort of math-driven, optically measured process is really important.
Yeah. And, like, there's so much that affects, you know, I mean, we're talking a lot about focus, but you could also be talking about exposure. We can also be talking about, you know, any other number of things. There are, of course, other devices other than the lens that are driving things like focus, right? There's, like, Prestons and stuff like that. How do those other peripherals fit into this discussion?
That's a great question. The ecosystem there, it depends on where in our conversations we have, it really depends on where's the source of the metadata. So obviously on Cook lenses and other eye technology lenses, the RNLDS lenses, the metadata is coming from encoders that are being factory calibrated to match the optical state of the lens. When you get into the Preston motors and how they can record metadata to other SD cards, the evolution of encoders that are trying to push back into the raw files inside the camera.
That's what I was going to ask about, getting those external feeds back into the internal.
The trend right now, the trend right now is to try and push things back through into the camera through various cable connections.
Because then you can trust it, right? Then there's
I
just can't begin to express how many times I've seen people just not trust a piece of paper, even though I was the one that wrote on it that, yes, this is the f-stop and this is what was going on. And they're like, yeah, whatever. They just, you know, put it to one side and then just say.
I think it's just very, here's the thing, is that the level of precision that it requires immediately creates a point where it may have been accurate, but if it doesn't generate the results people need, then or there's a lack of understanding in the process and the steps to apply that information, yeah, it gets thrown out because it's just eyeballing and schedules and deadlines all kind of become the known, the devil you know, shall we say.
So the whole system basically is open into some ways of getting those external feeds. If that is like, if I was using an older lens, let's say I was using something mm-hmm. that was literally a revamped, much older lens. It's clearly not going to have the technology built into the lens, yeah. But there are actually ways that I can get some data plugged still back in to the pipeline that we're talking about.
Yeah, like the Prestone motors, the DCS boxes all can have encoders that could work on analog lenses. As far as our system and where we're at and how we're trying to solve the distortion problem for visual effects, and I mean, it boggles my mind that it's still kind of a problem, 30 years on. But all of that is still relates to the focus, because that's then moving optical elements around, which then changes all the characteristics of the lens, which are then needed. And, our view is that if you had the right characterized lens and you had the right the accurate metadata that represented what happened in the lens, our system should work. We're starting with our lenses and to sort of reduce the variables. But fundamentally, if you have an accurate measurement that is synced against certain values on the lens, and the encoders, whether they come from the focus motor or they're separately and placed on the other side, if they match and produce the same metadata, the solution should still be the same.
I'm now going to state the most obvious thing in the world, but I'm going to say it anyway. The amount of power this requires on a camera and the amount of additional data it adds to a file are so minuscule as to be irrelevant. Like, there's no yes. cost to running cameras, and there's no cost to how big my files are when I get them back. It's just...
Well, yeah, I think even if you could get into a conversation with the DIT about which boxes and what additional cost and whatnot, the incremental cost of capturing metadata versus the reward of actually having it, can't mention the movie, but some of the figures that are being shared with us are in the order of $2 million in post-production costs saved through the use of metadata. That's very non-trivial. I mean, and then when you compare that against maybe a 20,000 pound or less fee for the extra work, the extra equipment, whatnot on a multi-camera shoot, it's just, how could you not want to do that?
So if somebody wants to find out more information about this to educate themselves, maybe they're listening to this and they're sort of like, hang on a second, I've not seen this or whatever. Presumably somewhere on the Cook site, there's somewhere that they can go to get more info.
Absolutely. If they go to our website, click on the products under eye technology, is the digital website that explains the system that we've got going. There's a form for a little yellow button where they can ask to be contacted. We're currently in a phase where we're supporting projects and basically giving access to the software and re-measuring lenses if they aren't pressure from the factory for the next few months, so that we can... through our testing, we've built up our view of what the savings are, but we want to validate that. So we're looking for partners to come on board and help us do that. So basically free software and services in return for feedback. But it's all there, and we'll continue to put out white papers. So if people sort of watch the Cook account on LinkedIn and my account on LinkedIn and that website, that's going to be where they can find all the info.
Yeah, and we started this conversation by mentioning we were both, traveling into Heathrow, but I want to applaud the fact that you're at FMX, because the reason that you're at FMX is not to sell lenses to DOPs, because that isn't a DOP kind of conference, right? So I applaud the fact that you and Cook have been and are continuing to be an educational bridge between production and post. I really do appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. And I honestly consider it a privilege that I've got this job where I can span between cinematography and visual effects, which have been two great loves of my life. And so for me, it's just a personal joy to be doing it.
Well, Brandon, thanks so much for talking to us today, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks again, Jordan, for joining us here on the FX Podcast and getting us up to date on the technology. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.